So this evening we're starting in James chapter 1 and verse 9, but we started the book in verse 3 with how are we supposed to feel when trials come into our lives?
Count it all joy.
Okay, so we're supposed to feel joy because we know that it produces endurance, and he calls endurance that which leads to perfection. And we become the kind of Christians that we ought to become. He doesn't mention the type of trials in verses 2 through 8. He just mentions different colors and different types and different shades of trials. So bereavements and loss of money, loss of health, nations rising and falling, depressions of the country. All of these things are trials. They're difficulties that come into our lives. And even though we don't want them and we don't enjoy them, is there something in the back of our mind that can keep the joy there? Yeah, this will lead to something good. And at some point in that trial, I need to be able to look back on it with joy. If I can't look back on it with joy, then what do I lack?
Wisdom.
And if I lack wisdom, what should I do?
Ask for it.
All right? So now, each one of us has a responsibility to go back in our lives and look at all the trials and all the difficulties and all the problems that we've gone through and assess how we feel about them. And see if we can actually say, at this point in my life, I've come to terms with this and I now feel happy and joyous. And again, that it happened? No, not that it happened. But that I got through it. It's going to come. I mean, there's no way we're going to get through this life without problems. I finished up the book of Ecclesiastes with Prince last night, and what does Solomon say is waiting on all of us? What color days?
Dark days.
And then he starts describing them. You're going to lose your ability with your legs. You're going to lose your ability with your arms. You're going to lose the ability to see, to hear, to chew, to be able to function. You're going to be afraid of heights, and you're going to have lots of problems. Now, can we get away from that? Yeah, but what do we have to do? What's the alternative? Yeah, all you have to do is die young. But that might be kind of a, maybe we don't want that choice. All right, so that's our marching orders. As we look at James chapter 1, James has said, I want you to feel joy with any kind of a trial that you come through, and if you can't, I want you to ask God for wisdom. So I hope we took some time this week and looked back on some of those things and decided whether or not we need more wisdom and started praying for it. Because that's what the, remember I put that chart up last week? How many commands are there in here? It's like 6 or 7 different commands. All right, now in verse 9, we start looking at wealth, poverty. And can you say wealth and poverty, or poverty and wealth are trials? Is wealth a trial?
Can be.
Okay, let's look at this verse at the very top of page 1. 2 things I request of you, deprive me not before I die, remove falsehood and lies far from me, give me neither what? Poverty
nor riches.
Now, I can understand why he wouldn't want the poverty, but who doesn't want riches? Well, look at the rest of it. Feed me with the food allotted to me, lest I be full and deny you. Do a lot of wealthy people leave the Lord?
Yeah,
wealth is a terrible temptation to some people. Because, first of all, we'll get into this more as the class proceeds, but those who are mindful to be rich do what? They put themselves into temptations and many diverse types of lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. And so wanting wealth is a dangerous thing. Matter of fact, desire to be rich, we shouldn't want that. Now, if we are rich, then, and unfortunately, rich is kind of an odd term for us, because who is not rich by biblical standards in America today? We're all rich. We're all rich. If we have a job, we have a home, we have a car, we have a television. You say, boy, those are pretty low standards. Well, no, they're not. Because most everywhere else in the world, you got those things. When I go to Malawi every year, third world country, and I sleep in some of their homes, and it's just a dirt floor and dirt walls and a window that just has a piece of wood that covers it when it's cold. And I think to myself, and they're happy as they can be. Because do they know they're poor? No, they don't. They understand that they don't have what people in the big cities have, but they don't see it that way. They don't see it the same way we do. So we need to be very careful. When Paul says those who are rich need to be charged to do certain things, do we say I get a pass on that because I'm not rich? And if you say that, you need to evaluate. And again, I'm kind of reviewing or overviewing, I guess. I guess reviewing, you can't review when you're just starting the class, but I'm giving you an overview. So let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation. Because as the flower of the field, he will pass away. Now, what does the scriptures teach about poor people? Is that a pretty serious trial? And I guess I should be careful here because it doesn't actually say poor here. It says lowly. But the lowly brother is contrasted with what? The wealthy brother. So, the wealthy brother and the lowly brother. Well, what has to happen to me for me to consider myself to be lowly? For me to consider myself to be in a situation that puts me at a disadvantage? When I come into the congregation, I'm beneath all the rest of them. What would have to happen for that for us to feel like that?
Physical poverty.
Well, physical poverty would do it. I think serious health issues can do it. Health issues that are so debilitating that you can't do. I've noticed over the last few years that I can't do as much work as I used to do, and it's really been bothering my self-esteem because I feel like I'm not faithful anymore. I'm not as faithful as I should be because I can't do what I used to do, and I sit myself down and have a talk to myself every once in a while, but it's still difficult. Now, what would happen to a guy like me if I got into an accident and I was paralyzed from the neck down? Would that make me feel lowly? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So serious health issues can do it. I think there are other things that can do it. But let's just leave it with that for now. I think wealth, though, would be the biggest thing that would cause us to feel that way in today's culture. And so the word lowly is a term that has to do, you see it right in the middle, or right toward the top of the first page. It means not rising far from the ground. It means to live in low regions, to be small, short, low, brought down, humbled, submissive, of low rank, lowly, mean, small, poor, weak. So like the term various trials, lowly kind of has different colors of meaning. And I think at least in the first century, with being a slave, maybe make you feel lowly. So slavery can do it. Poverty can do it. Health issues can do it. Other things can do it. So, but the lowly brother, what's he supposed to do?
Glory.
He's supposed to glory. Now, this is one of those situations where what we have what we call a paradox. What does the word paradox mean? Okay, it's something that is, yes, that's probably the best definition I've heard. It's something that's true, but it doesn't make sense. It's just exactly the opposite of what you would think. And so, normally, if you're rich and you're poor, you don't feel like this. So, this is, again, an education process. Now, I'm going to have to figure out why is it, how can I feel like that? But before I do that, I need to look at some of the concepts here. Now, first of all, I put about four proverbs in here that describe the deprivations of poverty. It isn't just the fact that you can't buy things. The destruction of the poor is their poverty. The poor man is hated even by his own neighbor. Wealth makes many friends, but the poor is separated from his friend. All the brothers of the poor hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He may pursue them with words, yet they abandon him. Now, why would that happen? Why would people who become poor be rejected or neglected? Ken?
Well, a lot of people think that riches mean that God is favoring them, so this guy must not be in any favor at all.
Okay.
That's not correct, but it's...
Yeah, well, that could very well be the case. Isn't that what Job's three friends did? But are there other reasons why when somebody poor comes up to you, you kind of hunker down a little bit?
They're going to ask because they want something.
Yeah. Oh my, here comes, I know what they're going to ask me for something. Now maybe they're not going to ask for something at all. But the Proverbs just makes it clear. Now, should Christians fall into this? No. But it's a natural feeling. It's a natural sense. When somebody walks in the door and you think that they're poor and you think they're going to ask you for something, then what's your temptation to do? Now, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to run away. So that adds to the stress of this poverty. But the brother is to glory. Now, glory and joy are two different emotions, but they kind of have a similar connotation. The term glory, I really like the second definition there. I bolded a couple of the lines there. To express an unusually high degree of confidence in someone or something, being exceptionally noteworthy. To boast. All right, so if something really good happens to me, what's my temptation? Well, I want to come in and talk to you about it. Man, I am so blessed today. Look at what happened to me. And isn't this wonderful? And so I'm boasting. Is all boasting sinful? Well, see, that's the point he makes. Look at that next. Whether in any particular context the boasting is legitimate or not, depends on what you're boasting. So if you're boasting about how much smarter you are than anyone else and how much greater you are than anyone else, or I did this because I'm smarter and greater than anyone else, then what kind of boasting is that?
Prideful.
See, that would not be a good boasting. So James counsels the poor to brag about their poverty or their lowliness. Now, there's a couple of conflicting contexts here that we have to get into. And I saved them for later in the book, but I just want to bring them up right now. What does Jesus say? If you want to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, what do you need to do?
Be the servant.
You have to become a servant. And what did Peter say? He who exalts himself
shall be humbled.
Will be humbled, and he who humbles himself
shall be exalted.
Will be exalted. So if I am in a natural state of being humbled, then what do I know God's going to do? He's going to exalt me. There's a passage. Well, let me deal with one other thing here, this term exaltation, then we'll turn the page. At the very bottom there, and again, the second definition I really like, so I bolded a part of it, the dimensions of height compared to other dimensions. All right, so hupso'o means something that's higher. Something that's higher than something else. So the dimension of height. Now, bathos, what does bathos remind you of?
Bath.
A bath, which measures the same dimension downward. So hupso is going upward, and bathos is going downward, which, interestingly enough, what does baptism come from? From this term here. And so it means to go downward. That's why we know it's an immersion. All right? Now, the dimension, though, is can also be a high place, like a mountain, highlands or heights, or it can be the height of dignity. All right? And it is also used as the title. If you ever wondered where the title Your Highness came from, yes, Your Highness, well, it came from this. It means someone who's been exalted to a higher position. And so, and then the last statement there at the very bottom of the page, sublimity of the wise and noble man. That's how the Greeks looked at this term. So this exaltation would normally be because I just won a race in the Olympics, or because I just became the valedictorian of the college, or because I just invented something that is going to give the company millions and millions of dollars and they've honored me. And so that's, but what am I basing it on here? My lowly state. My lowly state. I need to understand something. That lowly state in the heart of a Christian will create the same benefits as what we talked about in the beginning. If I go into a trial, what's it going to bring me? Approvedness. And it's going to bring me hope. Remember Paul in Romans chapter 5 there? We glory in our tribulations and our trials, knowing that tribulation works steadfastness or patience, and patience works approvedness, which means I have a sense that I'm approved, and approvedness works hope. Now, he's going to take it a little different direction. He's going to take it to the crown of life. But let's go ahead and turn the page. And I want to read this verse because I think it's the same basic concept. The verse that Paul gave us in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 there. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, use it rather. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's what? Freedman. And he who is called as a free man is what? Christ's slave. So, slavery, poverty, problems create an equal situation where even though someone is rich or poor, they just need to look at their situation in a very different light. The rich man is in grave danger. The rich man needs to... Does the rich man have a lot more responsibilities than the poor? Yeah, we're going to see in 1 Timothy, chapter 6, where Paul tells Timothy to charge those who are rich to be rich in good works, ready to share, willing to communicate or to offer fellowship of their finances. Now, is that a burden? Is it a burden to have to make sure that you use your money wisely? Because are we stewards or not? Yes. And what does stewardship require?
Faithful.
Faithful. To whom much is given? Much is expected. And to him who is given more, more will be required. So the people who have wealth, they need to evaluate what they're doing with their money. And if they're not using their money to be rich, in other words, if I can look back on this last year and I have to say to myself, you know, I haven't really done much with my money except put it in the bank. Is that a good thing? Because what happens to it when we die?
Goes to your foolish son.
Yeah, exactly. Well, or your foolish wife. The wife gets it first. Yeah. Well, okay, that's true. But more importantly, what does it do for you? Doesn't do anything, but what is, well, yeah, I guess we could use that in context. What about that rust? What about that rust that James talks about? You kept back some of the money from your laborers, and now what's going to happen? You're going to have to answer for that on Judgment Day. So the poor man is free from a lot of responsibilities and obligations that the rich man has. And the poverty itself, or the lowliness, the slavery itself, you know, when you think about it, if Paul converted a slave, could he do what he did with Timothy with him? Could he take him with him?
No,
he's a slave. So this slave who's working 10 hours a day, and then maybe, you know, remember how Jesus put it? After you get done working all day, does he say, let's all sit down and eat? No, he says, you tell the servant, you feed me and you take care of my needs, then you can eat. Now, would that be a trial? Yeah, that would be a lowly estate. But as far as the Lord is concerned, that's all that's required of him. Does he need to go out and convert his neighbors when he's working that like that? No. Does he need to be spending so much time doing things he can't do? No. He's going to be judged by his work. And that's Paul's point in Ephesians 6, in Colossians 4, when he talks about slaves. He says, your service to God is fully, completely fulfilled in treating your master like you would the Lord. And so when the person who is poor and in severe trials and he can't do anything, he simply needs to recognize that getting through this, that's all the Lord's expecting right now, is to get through this. Now, I'm not counseling that this is going to create laziness. I think if we have opportunity, we should buy it up. But if we don't, if we can't do it, we literally can't do it, are we required? No. As Paul said at the end of 2 Corinthians, what is it, 8 or 9, where he says, it's responsible as a man has, and not what he doesn't have. So we're not responsible. If I'm that widow and I can only put one mite in, or two mites, whatever it was, What does Jesus say? She put in more than all of them. Because they all gave of their superfluity or their excess. What did she give? All that she had. Well, a lot of poor people are giving a lot more percentage-wise than wealthy people are when you factor that in. So the promise of God to the people who are in lowly estate, people that are slaves, people that have health problems, people that are in poverty, you need to see that trial and glory in your exaltation. Now, are we going to need some wisdom for that too? Yeah, that's going to be tough. George?
It seems to me, not to disagree with what you've said, but the context here to me is saying it's talking about the concept when the lowly brother becomes a Christian and the faithful Christian and the rich does too. They both, the lowly one is raised up somewhat, if you will, and the rich is lowered by the fact that they are now considered, and rightfully so, to be equal in God's sight.
Yeah, but you're not, that's what I just finished saying. You're not disagreeing with me at all. That's what I just finished saying. You're just changing the context. I'm talking about if it happens after you become a Christian. What if it happens before you become a Christian? Does it not matter after you become a Christian, George, if you get hit with this after you become a Christian?
I'm not saying that.
I'm
saying it's not talking about what happens really before you become a Christian. In this context, I don't believe.
I don't know how you can prove that, George. It says, let the lowly brother. Doesn't say let the person who's a new convert.
Is a Christian.
Yeah, that's what. All right, let's just end that, George. I don't know what we're arguing about here. Verse 10, but the rich in his humiliation. Now, when a rich man becomes a Christian, what does he find out?
He has to be equal to the lowly brother.
Yeah, he's got nothing. All the wealth in the world does not make you any better than anyone else. And so the rich person has to go through humiliation. And the poor person has to recognize that he's been lifted up. And so whether this happens before you become a Christian, coming into becoming a Christian, or whether it happens after you become a Christian, the point is, when I see myself, regardless of how long it's been, how should I feel if I'm in a lowly state? I should feel exalted, right? I should feel I need to glory in my exaltation. How should the rich person feel? He should in his humiliation. And the but there means that everything that was happening in the previous verse is now applied in a slightly different way. It's not quite the same power as that Allah we talked about on Sunday, the adversative conjunction. This is a conjunction that simply places two things side by side, but instead of and, he puts a but here because the poor man glories in his exaltation, the rich man glories in his humiliation. So now we have a situation where the wealthy person, and I think we got a struggle here. Are we wealthy or not? Does this verse apply to us? Well, I think it does. But are we glorying in our humiliation? Do we recognize how humble we should be with our wealth? Wealth is a tool to be used. It is not a badge to be worn. It is not something that should give us self-esteem. It is something that should humble us, that we have the opportunity now to do something with it, right?
Yeah, and that's, to me, one of the beauties of the gospel when you think about the fact that all of us as Christians are equal. I think about Paul and Philemon and Onesimus and how Paul let him know, yeah, he belongs to you, he's your slave, but in Christ you're equal.
Right.
You're the same. Husbands and wives are called joint heirs. You know, they're working together to get to heaven. And so, you know, and it's something that we live in a society, especially in this very wealthy country where we are all very wealthy, where status means everything, your title, how much you make, the homes you live in, all this stuff. It's all about status. But with the gospel, it's completely different. And that is that we are all equal in Christ. And we have to keep that in mind. It's not about intelligence. It's not about wealth. It's not about any of that. It's about humbly serving the Lord as equals, joint heirs, those sorts of things.
Well, that's exactly right. But in order to accomplish that, the wealthy man, remember John's role? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. You remember John's role? He was supposed to do what with the mountains? Knock them down. What was he supposed to do with the valleys? Raise them up. Well, what's James doing here? If you're in lowly circumstances, you're raised up. If you are in exalted circumstances, you're brought down. And so, and this is a mindset. This is an attitude that we're supposed to have. And so what he's saying in verse 9 is that if you're in lowly circumstances, then you need to feel this sense of exaltation, and you need to boast in that. That Jesus Christ has died and lifted you up. And now, what have you got? What are you an heir of? We're an heir of all things. Who'd God create this world for? People like us. People that serve Him. People that honor Him. People to you remember Jeremiah 9:23? Let not the wealthy man glory in his wealth, but what should we glory in?
That we're saved.
That we know Him. That we know God. And that ought to be enough to have eternal life. Look at what happened to the rich man after he died. He's in torment. And he has squandered his opportunities with his wealth. And so now, as Abraham said, in this life you had your good things, but now you're tormented. So the lowly brother can glory that the gospel has lifted him up. What should the rich man do? He should glory that the gospel has brought him down. Because look at what Jesus said about it. Right on page 2, toward the middle, a little above the middle, it says, Jesus looked around at his disciples and said, how hard is it for those who have riches to enter the kingdom of God? The disciples were astonished at his words. But Jesus answered again and said unto them, children, how hard is it for those who trust in riches to enter the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, is that a good commentary on the 50, 60 years of prosperity that we've had in this country and the power of the gospel today versus what it was like right after the Depression or right after World War II when people were humbled? And so wealth is a serious problem. That's why the proverb has said, I don't want it. Give me neither poverty nor riches. And what did Jesus tell that rich young ruler? If you want to follow me, go sell it all. And what did he do? I can't do that. I'm sure he must have agonized over that. And that, as I've said so many times, hopefully on the day of Pentecost he had another chance. And he made the right decision the second time around. All right, so let's go ahead and turn to page 3. Because as a flower of the field, or like the flowering grass, he will pass away. So how long does wealth last? And, you know, actually, is it our wealth or is it on loan? Isn't that what stewardship means? When Jesus said that this man called in his stewards, and what did he do? Did they earn those 5 talents, 10 talents, 2 talents? No, he gave them to them. He assessed their ability, he gave them to them. Now, are we brought nothing in?
Carry nothing out.
Can't take anything out? We're just stewards. There's nothing about wealth that should bring this sense of self-esteem and boasting that so many people have. And yet we hear that in the schools today, one of the reasons people bully people is because they're wealthy and the other people are poor, or they've got athletic prowess and the other people don't, or they've got intelligence and other people don't. And it's just a natural temptation for people who have to look down on those who don't. But the sad reality is, where did it all come from? It came from God. If I'm intelligent, if I'm wealthy, if I'm good looking, if I'm athletically very good, what does that mean about me? Because God has blessed me and I should be grateful to God. I should be thankful to God that I can see and I brought myself down. Because if I stay up here where I'm so proud and arrogant, then what's that going to bring? Not going to bring anything good. So, and that's what that guy in the Proverbs was saying. So, Isaiah is the... Oh, go ahead, Charles, sorry.
No, I just wanted to ask a question here. Perhaps the class may want to acknowledge some. Well, when you look at people like the Oprah Winfrey, if you look at Bill Gates, if you look at the other guy just out of Warren Buffett, you know, these people here that have a lot of wealth, is it that they're thinking in that direction right there about what you're describing here about, you know, how easy it is for them to get money? They do have money. So they have these foundations and things that they have, you know, and so is that, would you say that's kind of on the same lines as what you're talking about right here?
Well, you remember at the turn of the century, what did they call those guys?
Robber barons.
Yeah. And why did they create unions? Because what were the robber barons doing? They were making those people work, and they were giving them nothing. And so they unionize, and they force the people to do that. So now, Bill Gates is totally different, though. He has spent millions, and I think almost more than that, maybe even close to the billions, trying to eradicate malaria from the world. And I've been watching him through the years, and he's using his money very well. So it kind of depends. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's some people. I think Bill Gates just got lucky. I mean, he just came along at the right time with a DOS, with an operating system that doesn't necessarily. I mean, he was smart enough to come up with the operating system, but to make all that money was just good marketing. And I guess for most of them, that's the case. But anyway, I'm not exactly sure what's your question.
I think you pretty much you're kind of covered this also too. But, you know, how you describe it, you know, the rich, you know, and how easy it is. If you take Bill Gates or whatever, everybody has a computer, they have a phone, and they have something. And that's going to be a contribution to him, to someone in that line. I know it's broken off into different type of companies or whatever, you know, but the idea, you know, of how they came about this, because it gets a lot of credit for that. And anybody that has a lot of riches where they can do a lot of things, you know, you go to different parts of the world, you have people doing things, you know, doing maybe in Africa or whatever, you know, is that, you think that they may have that type of idea, you know, about being brought down, you know, their estate being brought down to the lower state.
Right.
That's kind of what I'm getting.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting situation. I notice when I'm in Africa that the people there, because they don't have centuries and centuries of thinking, Christian thinking, we have a culture. How far back does our culture go? Western civilization. You know, it goes back 1500, 1400. And for all those years, all the authors and all the people that are writing, what are the, I mean, you talk about chivalry, you talk about all the fiction that's out there, and all the heroes have the same qualities, and they're Christ-like qualities. Have you ever noticed that? They're Christ-like qualities because that's what is important in our culture. Now, you go to a culture that doesn't have that. I try to teach these people, would you die for your wife? And guess what they do? They laugh. They think, that is the funniest thing I've ever heard of. I just waved bye-bye as he floated away. I said, you wouldn't jump in after her? Why would we do that? And yet in our country, and I tell them this, in our country, we see things very differently because of this ethic. I mean, for most people, if you saw somebody in a burning car, would you risk your life to go get them out? Most of us would. I mean, what do you think about it? But in a lot of cultures, they wouldn't because it's just never been taught. They've been taught a selfish way of looking at things. And the ancestral worships in a lot of these cultures, they don't teach that. They don't teach people to care about other people. And so, yeah, I think a lot of wealthy people in our country are judged by a very different standard than they would be. In Malawi, if you get elected, you are wealthy and you just step on all the people that got you there. You know, they make all these promises. It's worse over there than it is here. They make all these promises about what they're going to do if they get elected. And then guess what? They just do whatever they want to do afterwards. So, I don't know. Does that kind of answer your question?
No, we can move on.
Okay.
Wait. To add what Charles is saying, what you said is Bill Gates is an atheist.
Well,
God is his money. And then you know who died recently this year? Like Stephen Hawking. He was a very, very well-known...
Yeah.
He was an atheist, and he blurted it out before he died.
Nope.
I think
he's not anymore.
The Bible is a joke. It's horrible about what these people do.
Well, it's... Yeah, it's pretty sad. Okay, so we get now into this concept of the flower and the field. And let's just read verse 11, because I would like to at least get 11 done before class is over. The sun rises with a scorching wind. This is verse 11, bottom page 3. And withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. Now, God uses that. Look at right in the middle of the page, just a little above the middle of the page, where John the Baptist is the voice, and he says, "What shall I cry?" And what's he to cry? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness, that the flower of grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. So God takes something that only takes 2 or 3 days, and he says, "This is what I see with your life. You think you're born and you go through your youth and you go through your young adulthood and then you go through middle age and you go through old age and you think that's a long time. But I'm going to tell you what it really is. It's like what you see on the mountains. Every spring we see on the mountains all this beautiful, and then come back a few months later, what do you see?
Brown.
Just all brown. Where's the flowers?
Gone.
They're gone. He says that's what flesh is. And so verse 11 is just drawing from that. The sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. Well, he's not talking about the sun or the grass or the flowers or the beauty. He's talking about wealth. And he's using that because, you see, the word because, when the wealthy person is supposed to glory in his humiliation because as a flower, and for the sun rises with a scorching wind. So this is his explanation. This is his parable. This is his explanation of what wealth actually does for the individual. Wealth is like the flower. Wealth is like the grass. Flesh is like the flower and the grass. So let's go ahead and turn to the next page. And he makes his application, and we're not going to have much time to finish this, but let me just quickly make the application. So too, the rich man, in the midst of his pursuits, will fade away. And that's the saddest thing. And the Ecclesiastes deals with that. You're right in the middle. You've worked your whole life. You're just about to reach the pinnacle, and you're dead. And whose will it be? A lot of people don't even have a will. They don't have that son they're handing it down to. They don't have a will. Some people don't even have kids. They don't have a family at all. They've just spent their whole life. And the rich man, in the midst of his pursuits, will fade away. So is it better to be humbled when you get on the other side like the rich man? Or is it better to be humbled now?
No.
So what God wants from us is two things. If you find yourself in America in this lowly state, you've been brought down, you don't have these things, then you are commanded to glory in your exaltation because you're a Christian. But if you are wealthy, then you need to glory in your humiliation. So we need to do some work on this, because some of us, I don't feel, are as humble as we should be, or not as humbled. Go to a third world country and come back, and you'll feel that humility for a little while. You'll feel we don't deserve any of this. We're just blessed to have it. It's not our right. It's not something that everyone has. It is a tiny window in the world, and we're just so blessed to have it, and we should be very humbled, and we should recognize the responsibilities we have as a result of it. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there, and we'll pick up with verse 12 next week.